You know, I always like the turn of a century because collectively, globally, everyone kind of gets together and looks forward to what the century will bring them. And when the 1800s became the 1900s and what was known as the 20th century began, military technologies in the navies across the world were changing. Something called the Dreadnought had been designed, and the Royal Navy actually built the very first Dreadnought. And it was believed, correctly, that this one ship had changed naval warfare forever in many ways. One, the Dreadnought alone could beat or outrun everything that it came across, making it the most powerful ship in the world, even if it didn't have the most guns or was the biggest. It could sink everything it could, and everything it couldn't, it could run away from. And that was apparent. So much so that people who were building ships that were now called pre-dreadnoughts ceased building them, Germany specifically, and began building their own version of dreadnoughts. And dreadnoughts, while that being a very specific class of ship, gave birth to a design of dreadnought called the battle cruiser, which technically is not a dreadnought, but it's certainly a unique Royal Navy design that put the biggest guns on the fastest ship, sacrificing armor in place of displacement so it could maintain those speeds for long periods of time. And at the beginning of the 20th century, that was the direction the Royal Navy, that's the UK, England's Navy, the Royal Navy, was going. But they had also the largest navy in the world in terms of number of ships by far. Hundreds of ships. And of all these pre-dreadnought ships, there were a class called armored cruisers. And armored cruisers were the battleship of their day, if you will. A lot of guns. Guns for every situation. Large guns, a couple large guns. A lot of small guns, medium guns of different caliber. So that it was a ship for all situations. You know, large guns are hard to hit small, fast targets. But if you have a lot of smaller guns, they can adjust fire and fire faster and hit the smaller targets. So today's story, we're going to talk about that change and a new technology that came along in the early 20th century, late 19th century, called the submarine. And nobody really knew how powerful the submarine would be in naval warfare. Holland, over in the United States, had some really good ideas with electric boat. They built probably the most practical submarine at the time that the U.S. Navy was using for training, but it was slow, did not have any endurance to speak of, but it could submerge. And when it was submerged, it couldn't be hit with the guns of the time. It had to come to periscope depth or surface to be engaged. And this led to a conundrum. Let's go back to 1904, 1905. You have, you know, the first Sea Lord in the Royal Navy, and they're experimenting with submarine designs. They're aware of Holland's design over in the United States and what the United States is trying to do with submarines. And they build some of their own submarines, but they're not very impressive. As a matter of fact, they're called Jackie's Toys, referring to Jackie Fisher, first Sea Lord. That's because they don't really know how to employ them. There's no doctrine yet for these submarines. And Germany builds a couple, they call them U-boats, and they all have the same limitations. They're very slow, they can't go far, they're basically coastal defense, coastal patrolmen, and they could submerge, but they're useless when they're completely underwater, unless they're at periscope depth. And when they're at periscope depth, they can be detected. And then, of course, when they're on the surface, they're very slow, and you know they're lucky if they have any kind of gun to employ on the surface back in this era. And so that's what we're going to talk about today, is the Royal Navy really underestimated and mocked submarines in the early 20th century. They didn't understand their power. They didn't understand how to employ them. They jokingly called them Jackie's Toys. And while they were doing this, they were building dreadnoughts, dreadnought class ships, and battle cruisers. That was really the big thing. The new hotness was the battle cruiser. the Royal Navy had two very different admirals in charge of their fleet. The first was First Sea Lord Fisher, and the second was Admiral Beatty. And the general consensus of the Admiralty itself was that submarines were ineffective in warfare because of their limited range and speed. Because of this, them not understanding it, it led to a culture of mocking submarine officers, mocking submarine sailors as being cowardly, as hiding beneath the waves to launch a sudden surprise attack and then skulking away like a coward. And those words were used to describe submarine crews, not to their face for their own Navy, but other navies. The Royal Navy would accuse the German Navy sailors of such cowardice. It was not the proper way to fight. In this age of battleships and battle cruisers, men and officers stood by the rails and shot each other. Dignified, you know. And that's not the way submarines were going to fight. So they underestimated them. They mocked them. And then August 1st, 1914 comes along and Germany enters World War I, which triggers everybody else to get into the war, including England. And now you have the Royal Navy versus the High Seas Fleet of Germany going at each other. And it doesn't take long before the submarines come into effect. One of the very first significant engagements of submarine warfare happened on September 22nd, 1914, in the morning at sunrise, 0600, German U-boat U-9 with Captain Wendigen on board has just charged his batteries and is preparing for a day of patrol in what's known as the Greater 14s, or the Broad 14s. That's in the southern Northern Sea. Imagine the body of water that's on the eastern side of where the English Channel begins, the body of water that is on the southern part of the Northern Sea between Norwich, England, and the coast of the Netherlands. That is this body of water here. And that's where the submarine is patrolling. War has just begun about a month earlier, and the submarines are out there looking for targets. Germany had a policy of sinking any merchant that wasn't going to a neutral port. So if it was a merchant, no matter what country it was going from, if it was supporting the war effort on the other side, that was a target. They were going to sink that. And that's what the U-boat's looking for. On the Royal Navy side, they have set up patrols to keep the High Seas Fleet in their port. Or if they come out, these patrols of ships, these armored cruisers, would detect it, would engage it, and then do their best and try to get away. But the armored cruiser captains referred to themselves as 20-minute ships. They knew that if they were going to go against Germany's, you know, dreadnought classes, they didn't stand a chance, right? They understood that they were the live bait squadron. And we're going to begin by talking about the live bait squadron on the morning of September 22nd, 1914. This is three ships of the Creasy class. And these three ships, all identical, same class of boat, are running line of breast. One, two, three, left, right, and center. And they're heading south to north following the Netherlands coastline, just off the coast. And they're waiting for anybody to come out of Germany so they can radio the position, engage, and fall back towards England for support, because they know they won't last 20 minutes against a dreadnought. Well, what they don't see is the very small U-9 that's coming from the north south right in their path. So the submarine, seeing the three armored cruisers coming line abreast, basically right at their position, sees them hundreds of yards, thousands of yards before they're detected. So they submerge. U-9 is now at periscope depth, watching three armored cruisers come right at them. Captain Wendigen maneuvers his U-9 at periscope depth to be between two of the three armored cruisers. And at a range of about 1,000 yards, launches a single torpedo. He only has six torpedoes total on board. Launches a single torpedo towards the center armored cruiser. This one is HMS Aboukir. Well, HMS Aboukir explodes, takes the torpedo directly amidship on its port side, and begins flooding, comes to a stop. And they hear the explosion inside the submarine. The crew is jubilant. They just had their first successful shot of the war, and they're about a month and a half into it. Like, it's just begun. So they begin to maneuver, spiraling away from contact, back towards the north and then towards the east, towards land. The other two cruisers, the HMS Creasy and the HMS Hoagie, both come in from the port and the starboard side towards the center, the one that was just torpedoed, to render assistance. The radio call is that HMS Aboukir has hit a mine. So sure, and they knew there were mines in the area. They just didn't realize that they were in a mine field. HMS Aboukir is taking on so much water and has lost propulsion. They've shorted out their dynamos, so they lost electricity. It's dark inside the hull now, and they lost dewatering capability. The ship is going to roll over to port and sink. This is apparent to the captain. Captain John Drummond on board the HMS Aboukir calls abandon ship. Men start jumping into the water. There's little time for lifeboats at this point because the flooding is so catastrophic from this little 45-centimeter torpedo, one that we would call a light torpedo today, hit this ship in such a way that it flooded an engine room and is sinking the ship to the port side. U-9, as it's maneuvering towards land, towards Netherlands, at a submerged depth of less than 160 feet, because that was its test depth, comes back up to periscope depth for battle damage assessment. It knows it's got a hit. It doesn't realize how catastrophic the single hit was. When it sees that the HMS Aboukir is rolled over, he sees the red hull still wet from the water it had rolled over from, with men on board walking along the keel as if it's a surfboard, waiting for rescue as the two other Cressy class armored cruisers come in, one on the port side, one on the starboard side, to pick up swimmers and survivors. The U-9 captain has a choice. He realizes he could easily sink another cruiser here because they're slowing to respond to survivors in the water. And he has two reloads in the forward torpedo room, and one of his torpedo tubes is still loaded. He loads the second torpedo tube while submerged, and that's a big deal in this time and age. This had been done in test trials, sea trials before, but it was not common in 1914 to reload your torpedo tubes while submerged. That was considered a dangerous operation, and it was. But he does it. So now he's got two torpedo tubes on his bow that are loaded again, and he shoots two torpedoes at the second ship, HMS Hoagie, as it's coming in to pick up survivors. It's a target that's slowing down, and he has to close to within 600 meters to make sure the shots hit because of the change in speed. Both of these torpedoes hit the port side of the USS Hoagie as it comes into survivors, blowing two gaping holes into it, flooding its engine room and its crew compartment forward, immediately loses power, lights off inside this dark hull, water rushing in, drowning sailors, and it's rolling to its port side, sinking faster than the original hit. We now have two capsized ships with one HMS Creasy between the two of them, trying to pick up survivors. And now Creasy knows this is not a minefield. This is a submarine torpedo attack, and he sends off a distress call. Unknown submarine, this position, request help, and help is on the way now. Destroyers are firing up their engines and coming across the North Sea to render assistance to Creasy. Now the Captain Creasy has reported the submarine. He has a choice to make. There are hundreds of men still alive in the very cold North Sea water, asking for rescue, raising their hands up with their life jackets on, as Creasy drives slowly through this field of men. They pick up as many as they can. Now that both bow torpedo tubes of the U-9 are empty, the captain has a choice to make. Again, the U-9 captain. He can go back to port, or he can shoot his two aft torpedo tubes at the remaining vessel. And that's what he chooses to do. He positions himself. He drives south for about 30 minutes. As the Creasy comes in and starts picking up survivors from the two ships that are now sunk, the submarine drives south, turns to the east, facing the aft end of the submarine towards the last remaining armored cruiser, and fires both aft torpedo tubes. There was one torpedo left in the forward torpedo room, by the way, and they start reloading that one last shot. The torpedo runtime is only 31 seconds for this shot, and they hear one explosion. So the captain assumes that one missed and one hit, and he now has one torpedo remaining in the forward torpedo room, and he's facing east. He can run away now. His batteries at this point, after about an hour of engagement, are drained. He'll need to recharge them. He cannot stay submerged. He pops up the periscope for battle damage assessment on the shot that he just took, and he sees the HMS Casey, the last remaining cruiser, is hit, is smoking, and listing to starboard, the side that the torpedo hit. He knows that if he surfaces, there's a chance that the HMS Casey can take a shot at him. He's only 1,000 yards away and will probably destroy his submarine. He could wait, but there's destroyers on the way. He knows the distress call has been sent. He cannot stay here. And he's got one weapon left. Captain Windigan decides to turn back to the west and shoot his last remaining torpedo into the starboard side of HMS Casey. The periscope gets right to the edge of where the swimmers are in the water, only 600 yards away from a stricken HMS Casey. Takes its last shot. The torpedo goes right under the feet of hundreds of people in the water, striking HMS Casey, exploding it with a second hit, and it quickly capsizes to starboard side. Men clinging to the hull. There's very few lifeboats, and the ones that are in the water are overwhelmed with swimmers. Swimmers in the water, both with and without life jackets. There's debris everywhere. People are holding on to anything that will float, including each other, which often drowns more sailors than the actual attack in this case. Completely out of weapons at this point, with no battery, the captain of the U-9 decides to leave the area. He immediately gets away from the, using the last of his battery, gets away from the ship that's capsized, surfaces on the port side of the ship, and begins running his diesel generators to maximize his speed back north again, just trying to get away from the attack. These three ships were sunk in about 90 minutes on the morning of September 22nd, 1914. The most successful submarine attack of World War I has just happened. 36,000 tons of cruiser warship is sitting on the bottom of the Broad 14s this morning. The destroyers that have been scrambled have come out to find the culprit. They never find the U-9 because despite being on the surface and much slower than the destroyers coming to find them, the captain wisely heads towards the Netherlands and masks his kerosene-burning snorkeling submarine against the rising sun and the landmass that will obscure his silhouette. The U-9 got away. Over a thousand sailors died that morning. There was a huge blow to the prestige of the Royal Navy, and they now understood the weapon that the Germans had. This submarine was highly effective, and it changed tactics. The Royal Navy were afraid of submarines coming into their ports because, shockingly, in World War I, in 1914 when it began, Scapa Flow had no defense. They had no anti-submarine nets. They had no anti-torpedo protection against any ships that were moored to the port. They didn't even have guns at the entrance to the harbor in 1914. All that came later. And Jackie Fisher and Admiral Beatty were scared to death. And the rhetoric with submarines changed. It was no longer a coward's weapon. It was a weapon of terror. This was piracy. But it was underestimated because they didn't understand it. And so this little German U-boat, this little 600-ton, two-electric engine with four diesels pushing it that can only do about, 14 knots at max speed on the surface, changed naval warfare in a way that the Dreadnought did, but in favor of the smaller fleets who can't afford the Dreadnought battlecruiser style of warfare. And Germany had a lot of submarines.